It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about an effort to support women in science and engineering, the Earth Science Women's Network.
First, Wisconsin officials are working to improve the statewide emergency communications network. The Wisconsin Interoperable System for Communications, or WISCOM, network lets public safety agencies communicate across the state.
Danielle Kading joins us now. She's a WPR news reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. How you doing?
Good. Well, let's start with the basics, Danny. Tell us how WISCOM works.
Well, it is a statewide network, statewide radio network, that allows, as Rob said, public safety agencies to communicate across the state through portable radios. It offers 95% coverage, 95% of the time, anywhere in the state. So if a public safety agency like the sheriff's office here in Douglas County wanted to talk to somebody in Madison at the Wisconsin DOJ, they could do that by using these portable radios.
And we have a clip of Josh Ribb, who's the WISCOM program manager at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, talking about the importance of the system for interagency communication.
Prior to the system, there was really no way to do that except for cell phone coverage, which was kind of spotty along that entire route. And in order, if they had any problems along that entire route, the only radio systems they could communicate on are ones that they had programmed in their radio. And there's quite a few counties along that trip, so they'd have to have those dispatch centers and everything programmed in the entire way.
So, Danny, a picture there of the importance of this system, but who pays for the maintenance of it?
Well, right now, this started out with 80 state-owned towers. It's grown since then to include 116 towers across the state. And so the state-owned towers are run by, the Department of Health Services, Department of Corrections, Wisconsin DOT, and Wisconsin DOJ, and they have funding included in their budgets to help maintain the system. But those sites that have been added on by local agencies, whether it's county or city, they pay for their own system and the upgrades and the infrastructure.
And there has been a consultant hired to take a look at some of the issues, upcoming issues, and also to see how other states handle the maintenance costs. And what is that the consultant found about who pays for this emergency system in other states?
Well, I don't know what the consultant has found yet because they have yet to release their final draft report. But the consultant was hired last year to look at surrounding states and how they are operating similar networks. And in Minnesota, for example, they have state funding to support their system, which is called the ARMOR system. And they receive about $11.5 million a year in state funding to support maintenance of the infrastructure and the radios as part of that network. But in Illinois, it's owned by a provider, or the sites are owned by a provider. So those agencies that want to be a part of the network or use it have to pay a monthly user fee, as it was explained to me. Michigan, they also receive state funding, and I believe that's around $40 million annually to keep up their system and provide for the kind of improvements and the maintenance.
And what do counties around the state here in Wisconsin have to say about some of these different options?
Well, counties like Douglas County are opposed to any kind of user fee to be on the system. And the reason for that is, for those counties or cities or communities that have taken that extra effort of building their own tower or adding their own radio infrastructure to provide more coverage for emergency services in their counties, they really don't want to have to pay any more into that to maintain those systems. So, and with the way state funding is and federal funding, counties are stretched thin on their budgets. They're trying to stretch the dollar as far as they can. And so to have to pay anything further would be a burden on those local governments.
We're talking with Danielle Kading right now, WPR's news reporter based in Superior. And we're talking about what Wisconsin officials are doing to improve the statewide emergency communications network. And Danny, looking at the funding as it stands right now, how does the state pay for it?
How does the state pay for it currently?
Currently.
Yeah, well, As I said before, those state agencies like Department of Health Services and the Department of Corrections, they have funding included in their annual budgets to account for ongoing maintenance, and they strive to upgrade at least 4 towers or the equipment for those things each year. As for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, the Wisconsin State Patrol, and Wisconsin DOJ, there's roughly just a little bit more than $1 million. And so that means that there's not a whole lot of money that can go into maintenance or adding on new sites.
So if there's a gap in coverage, I know there's one in Plover, what happens about the cost there?
Well, for example, you mentioned that there are some areas that need coverage to be filled in. And so that's the current challenge that the state is facing, is how do we fill in these coverage needs when we have a limited pot of resources available, which is why they're doing the study to examine what kind of resources that they can bring to bear to meet the communications needs across the state and fill that in. In Plover, I believe they have a DNR tower where they're currently adding infrastructure there to help improve portable radio communications in that area. But there has to be money in the long term to support the kind of upgrades that are going to need to happen as the equipment for these radio networks reach their end of life.
So we mentioned some gaps in coverage. What other kinds of improvements do you think Wisconsin officials are looking at to make the system better and to keep it moving forward into the future?
Well, one thing is consistency, and the other thing is training. Anytime you roll out a new way of doing things, you have to make sure that people understand how that system works, how to use these radios, and how to keep up the system or properly implement it so that you're not doing things that may be detrimental in the long run. So they're looking at what kind of things that they can do so that they have efficient communication between emergency services across the state and a level of consistency so that everyone everywhere who has one of these sites is doing it virtually the same so that nobody's confused and everyone's on the same page.
And we have a little bit from Josh Ripp again, the WISCOM program manager at the Wisconsin DOJ, and he's talking here about how this study will be used.
Once the study is completed, we can move forward with management at DOJ and DOT to find the resources to make improvements and plan for the system for the future. Improving coverage and operability across things, as well as provide the training and assistance to the users on the system to make them the best use of the system as well.
And Danny, you said the report from the consultant is not in hand yet, but what happens next?
Well, it sounds like they're finalizing a draft report of what the consultant is recommending as to how to move forward and things that can be done to maintain and fund the system. And the Wisconsin DOJ is expected to review that internally in the next couple of weeks.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Danielle Kading, WPR news reporter based in Superior, and she was with us there to talk about what Wisconsin officials are doing right now to improve the statewide emergency communications network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, our guest says it's possible to balance work and family. For some people, she says the answer is hitting pause on your career. We'll talk to the author of Work, Pause, Thrive.
Right now, during Women's History Month, we're talking about women in science. According to a National Science Foundation 2015 special report, men make up 71% of the workforce in science and engineering occupations, even though women make up 50% of the total U.S. college-educated workforce.
While women's share of full-time full professorships in the STEM fields has more than doubled since 1993, women are in only about a fourth of these senior faculty positions. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. The numbers are even worse for minority women. They comprise fewer than 1 in 10 employed scientists and engineers in the United States.
One resource for women in science is the Earth Science Women's Network, known as ESWN. Tracy Holloway is the president and co-founder of ESWN, and she joins us now to talk about it. She is a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Veronica. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's a neat origin story behind the Earth Science Women's Network. Can you tell us how it came to be?
Yeah, well, maybe first I'll just jump to the punchline, which is to say that today the Earth Science Women's Network, or ESWN, has over 3,000 women working in over 60 different countries. Mm-hmm. And we're the largest organization of women in the geosciences or earth sciences, meaning meteorology, oceanography, geology, soil science, space science, volcanoes, the whole nine yards. And when we started ESWN, we had no idea that it was going to grow to be this large. In fact, at the time, in 2002, I was a postdoc working in New York City at Columbia University. And some friends and I, who all were finishing up our PhDs, we met at a large scientific conference in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we said, gosh, we should stay in touch because we're all going through these transitions that are affecting our careers, figuring out what jobs to take, whether to move across the country, even if you have a boyfriend who doesn't want to move, what to wear to an interview, how to make the decisions about crafting a career. And many of these questions were things that were too personal to ask our boss or our PhD advisor, but they were often too career relevant or professionally important to just rely on our girlfriends or our moms. And so we started talking with each other, and most of these issues at the time just seemed very personal. Like, who can you talk to about whether to take a job in California? But in time, we found that actually the issues that we were each facing individually were pretty typical of the kind of problems and challenges that are facing all scientists, but that have a particular resonance for women, because the typical scientist may move five or six times between the ages of 20 and 30. You move for college, then you go someplace for graduate school, you take a two-year postdoctoral position, maybe another such position. If you're lucky, you get a permanent job after that, but you don't really know actually if it's permanent, especially, for example, a tenure track professor, until you get tenure, which is then another 6 years. And these kind of moves are disruptive to anybody, but the ages of 20 to 30 are, for many women, the time that they're settling down, having kids, these kind of issues. So we started as a peer mentoring group for each other. But we said, if this is helpful for us, maybe we should open the doors and make this an organization that any woman who would find it useful can join. So we doubled almost every year after that.
Wow. So that shows that there's quite a need for this, an appetite to have this sort of mentoring in place. And how was it developed over the years? I mean, it sounds like it started with pretty personal questions about, should I take this job in California? My boyfriend maybe doesn't want to go. It was kind of personal. Does it still have that intimacy?
You know, I think that we've kept some of the intimacy. But of course, as you grow, you can do new things that you couldn't have done when you were just six people. And you know, that changes the culture of an organization. I would say almost right away, we started expanding beyond just women and just the earth sciences. Probably in our first or second year, we started a jobs network, which is called the Earth Science Jobs Network. It is a listserv with over 5,000 subscribers, and it is hosted by the National Center for Atmospheric Research and posts probably 15 jobs a day. Many of them are academic type positions, but it's free to subscribe and free to post. And I think it was one of these situations where right away we saw something that was useful for the women in our network, sharing jobs, but then this is something that shouldn't be kept within any one gender, and so we made sure to open the jobs network. We also developed some career training programs, things like how do you figure out your career, and how do you build a professional network, and how do you communicate your work effectively. And we found that, again, these training programs, while we developed them for our members who are women at early career stages in the earth sciences, were actually useful for everybody. And now we run a series of career workshops every year at the American Geophysical Union meeting, which is a huge meeting with 29,000 people in San Francisco. And our career workshops are free and open to anybody who wants to attend. So we have been broadening our scope to serve a wider network of scientists. And actually, just a couple years ago, some of our board members launched a program to extend our model of peer mentoring to first-year college students, especially women college students who may be one of the few women in their undergraduate classes and trying to decide, should they stay in a STEM major or should they leave? So we've been running workshops and developing platforms for the women to connect online with the goal of making their experience through college welcoming and supportive, and making sure that nobody is switching out of STEM just because they feel isolated.
Right, I wanted to ask you about that. It sounds like a lot of the offerings have been made inclusive to anyone who wants to join them. But is there still something that uniquely serves the women in the sciences and STEM who may feel isolated depending on where they're working and how old they are, where they are in their careers, and they may not have that mentor there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we still have a discussion group online with over 3,000 people, but there's a lot of subgroups that is for women only. And that's partly because our members have asked for that. They've said that they value having this environment where they can talk about things that may be very personal, from where to breastfeed to how to deal with a uncomfortable situation at work. And this has been a forum for those kind of discussions. But we found that actually what one person views as their own personal problem is often a systematic issue. You may feel like you're not being nominated for awards, and that's hindering your professional progress. And you may take it personally. But actually, what we found working with different professional societies is that women in general are not being nominated as much for awards, and that women in general are not nominating each other for awards, and that there's a lot of unwritten rules about how that works. So what we found is that often one person's personal problem translates into some suggestions about how science can change to be more welcoming, and that we're in a position to be working with organizations to try to move change forward.
We're talking with Tracy Holloway right now, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She's a co-founder of the Earth Science Women's Network, and we're talking about that network right now. And Tracy, you mentioned some of the strands of conversation that go on, and one you mentioned was breastfeeding in the field. Now, this is something that probably, I mean, I can imagine that could still be a relatively new question, given the demographics of who's in STEM right now. Are there other areas like that where it really helps to have women talking to each other about some of the unique problems and questions that they may face?
Yeah, there's a number of interesting examples. One is this question of, if you get married, should you change your name? Because, you know, all of us who have gotten married or are considering getting married have to think about that question. But as a scientist, really, from the minute you enter graduate school, you're trying to make a name for yourself. You're trying to build your reputation as a scientist. And if you publish a couple of papers under your maiden name, and then you're ready to make the leap to get married, well, you know, what are you giving up by changing your name? What are the professional consequences of suddenly going from a name that may be getting some traction to a name that nobody knows in your field? And when we had our first conversation about this topic, it's a topic that's come up many times over the years, but actually we had so many people weigh in with their experiences that we summarized them all and made some plots, because, you know, we are scientists. We really like to make plots. And, you know, talked about the women who had changed their names and were happy they'd changed their names, who'd changed their names and wished they hadn't, who used one name for their personal activities and a different name for their scientific activities. Just knowing that there's these different experiences and different alternatives, we've heard from many of our members, were helpful for them personally in making that big decision.
And I wanted to ask you if you see this now, the success of this, how it's grown as a model for women in other areas that your group doesn't particularly represent, where women are underrepresented.
Yes, absolutely. Over the years, I've talked to women in different fields of science who've been thinking about using ESWN as a model for their own work. And, you know, we're always happy to share our lessons learned and what's worked for us and what hasn't. We are personally also interested in expanding the scope of work that we serve because, you know, already the earth sciences cuts across chemistry, physics, math, engineering, many fields of ecology, biology, other disciplines. So on the one hand, it's a self-contained area, but it has connections with so many areas of STEM, and we all teach classes. Many of us teach classes at universities with undergraduates and graduate students across different areas of science and technology that, you know, our goal is to, you know, be as supportive and inclusive as possible, no matter what field of science or engineering.
And do you see programs like this maybe as helping to turn the tide and get these numbers of representation for women up in the STEM fields? You say you're working with undergrads in particular. Is this something you think that is proving to be effective, getting more women into STEM?
I think so. We are, you know, the bulk of our work is focused on these early career women, graduate students, postdocs, early career faculty, because these are women who've already made huge commitments in science as a career. And if we can keep these women in and make sure that they are on the pipeline to advance, then it's setting up role models for the next generation of women. And we do work with societies to track some metrics of how many women are attending meetings, how many are getting prestigious awards, how many are nominated for different prestigious outcomes. And it really is going up and up.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it today.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
That was Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, also the Department of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she was with us here to talk about the Earth Science Women's Network, which she helped to found.
Coming up after the news, our guest has advice for how to take a pause in your career and focus on family without killing off your career. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, thousands of people in Wisconsin have multiple prescriptions for antipsychotic drugs that shouldn't be taken together. A guest shares her new report on the overprescribing of mental health medications.
First, for a long time, the conventional wisdom for new parents has been if you downshift your career or take some time off to be with your kids, you'll pay a price in your work life when you try to ramp back up again. Our next guest says that's outdated thinking, and it is possible to focus on your family for a while without sacrificing your career.
Leeson Stromberg joins us now. She's a journalist, speaker, and the author of the book Work, Pause, Thrive, How to Pause for Parenthood Without Killing Your Career. She's also COO of the 3% Movement. Leeson, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, for years, we've been hearing that taking the off-ramp to focus on family and raising kids is, especially for women, a kind of career suicide, that it's tough to get back on track in the workforce. And you see it a little differently. How come?
I do, Veronica. It's fascinating. When Lean In came out, I heard so many young women ask me directly, how do I do this? How do I navigate my career? And I had known in my own journey, and many of the women I had interviewed as a journalist and also that I just sort of saw out in the work world, they had actually downshifted or paused temporarily, either left completely the paid workforce or downshifted work part-time and eventually managed to relaunch to great success. And I said, okay, well, if I'm seeing that, is that the anomaly or is that the rule? So I went out to find out. I ended up interviewing 186 women and surveying 1,500 more for my book, Work, Pause, Thrive, And what I learned is, in fact, the vast majority of women actually did for a period of time downshift, not for that long, but managed to relaunch to great success. It was incredibly inspiring.
And this is your story, too, in effect. I guess you didn't know if you were one of the only ones, but you had a big career in advertising, and you surprised yourself by wanting to downshift your career. Can you tell us how you got to your point?
Well, let's be clear. I actually didn't want to downshift my career. What I found is that it was really challenging to be a very engaged mother and a very committed professional in the workplace. That the kind of environment that says we have to be all in all of the time was great if you had a stay-at-home partner, but I had a husband who had an equally engaged and committed career, and it just ended up being really challenging for the two of us. And I tried to downshift and work part-time with my employer at the time, and they just were not interested. So I said, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to innovate and create something new and different in my own way. What I ended up doing is shifting. I ended up becoming a journalist, and ultimately now I'm back making change in the advertising industry because, sadly, not much has changed in the last 20 years.
You use the word innovate, and I think that's part of the key based on the stories in your book, that that's something that the women who have taken this downshift, they come back and they do something innovative. They're a little more flexible maybe than just climbing the ladder one rung at a time. Can you talk about the role of innovation?
Oh, it's a great question, Veronica. Thanks for asking it. So here's what we've learned. I saw that people had essentially four paths. The first path was women who never downshifted or paused. They were all in all the time. Interestingly, those women didn't leave for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was they loved their jobs, they were thriving, and they had the flexibility they needed to be engaged parents. So they didn't feel the need to leave. The second group were women who actually stayed in the game. I call them cruisers. These were women who downshifted to work part-time. Women, for example, like Rosine Matthews. She was in banking, paused for 3 years, and then went back into banking and now is a senior vice president at Wells Fargo. Didn't hurt her career at all to actually downshift for a period of time. There's another group of women that I discovered, which I call boomerangs. Roseanne's sort of like that. They're people who downshifted. They completely left the paid workforce and then boomeranged back to their previous career. Quay Maddox, who was a producer with a major television agency, paused for 15 years, I think it was almost 15 years, and now is relaunched as a producer at CNN. She's a perfect example of a boomerang. And the last group are people I called pivoters. They're the people who literally took that period of time of pausing to say, what do I really want to do with my life? What kind of difference do I want to make? What is a life well lived? And they're the ones who, in many ways, were the most innovative. They shifted completely and created new careers and new opportunities for them. Marianne Perrin is an example of that. She was a big technologist. She was a vice president of finance and operations. She pivoted, and ultimately she ended up becoming a professor of nutritional science, and she's now a professor at the University of North Carolina. It was these stories that were so inspiring to me and so reflective of how these women were just trailblazing paths because the workplace didn't allow them to really thrive. They did it on their own.
Now, I want to ask you about the workplace and what role that plays, because for some of the women you talked to, they were able to go part-time, so they were able to focus, you know, spend more time with their families, but then maybe they had a really sympathetic boss who said, sure, you can go down to 75%, and they did, but then, you know, not everybody has that. That did not seem to be the rule. It was the exception.
You're absolutely right, Veronica. It was really interesting. I learned so many stories of women who had quietly and carefully navigated a reduced schedule, but who didn't tell the other employees, or their employer refused to let them tell other people. So you never knew that, in fact, they were working part-time. I tell the story of a close friend of mine from college who was a very senior executive in a luxury goods industry. She downshifted for 10 years, and I never even knew. And her answer to me when she finally revealed it was, my employer didn't want anyone else to know, so we didn't tell anyone I was only working 4 days or 3 days a week. So we have these hidden stories that we don't know. But to your point, they are the exception. They're not the rule. We're finding that many people want this solution just for a period of time, a short period of time, and aren't getting it because everyone says, well, that can't happen. It can't work. But in fact, what I saw is it happens and works all of the time.
We're talking with Liesen Stromberg right now. She's the author of the book Work, Pause, Thrive, How to Pause for Parenthood Without Killing Off Your Career. And Liesen, are there rules that make a pause like this successful, sort of benchmarks that all of these women had in common?
Well, you know, you're asking a great question. So in the research that I did for Work Pause Thrive, I found a number of sort of patterns of behavior that I thought were really inspiring. The first one is the women consistently had a real sense of their own value. I mean, we talk about female confidence and all of this, but they really understood, I have something to offer, and if I can't thrive in this environment, I'm going to find another environment in which I can thrive. And they were very willing to adapt and iterate until they could find it. So that real sense of, I have value to offer, I want to bring this to the workplace, I'm going to partner with my employer to make it work, and if that doesn't work, I'm going to take my talents elsewhere. The other thing they had, and this is something that, interestingly, in the survey I didn't ask about, and they told me in volumes in the comments section, was the power and importance of having a great partner. And now,
Leeson, are you there? I can hear you. Oh, now you're back. Terrific. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
You said
having a windstorm here in San Francisco.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, you had just said something about the power of a great partner.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. It was incredible to me. So many of the women shared that it was their partner that actually allowed them to thrive. That, in fact, their partner kept their careers alive, you know, made introductions when they were ready to relaunch, or spiraled themselves. The partner might have downshifted for a period of time while the other, you know, while the women themselves were trying to advance their career. So we saw some career spiraling going on. The other thing that women did was they always considered themselves nurturing their career whether or not they were in the paid workforce. They networked. They went to conferences. They, you know, used social media to continue to build their brand. They didn't look at whether they were being paid or not as a measure of whether their career was thriving. They looked at their career and the long view and really nurtured it along the way.
Did you look at all about whether this was an option that was available to all women or just women, say, who had a partner, who had a certain degree of wealth? Or did it turn out that taking a pause was maybe more of a luxury good for some parents?
Well, it's a really great question. So in the survey, what I did was I limited it to women who had a college degree and women who were mothers. And the reason I did that is because I was asking myself, what's the break point of women's careers? You've invested all this time and money into your career, you know, by going to college, et cetera. What does that look like? But what I learned was, in fact, we're seeing a huge increase in women in the middle classes and under-resourced women who are pausing, not because they necessarily want to, but again, because the workplace is so constrained and because our public policies don't support parents in the workplace. We don't have paid maternity leave. We don't have universal child care that's affordable and high quality. And so we're seeing women and men, frankly, kind of be forced to make solutions. I will say that the women I interviewed, the majority of them actually were in long-term relationships, whether they were married or not, not necessarily required that. But they did have partners that allowed them to downshift for a period of time, or that they could then have support and allow to their partners downshift. So, yes, that's, you know, those were some of the things that we're seeing happen. That's the way it worked. So if you're a single parent, it's a lot harder, obviously.
Leeson Stromberg is joining us right now. She's a journalist, a speaker, and the author of the new book, Work, Pause, Thrive, How to Pause for Parenthood Without Killing Your Career.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Did you take a pause in your career at some point to focus on family, leaving the workforce for a while, dialing back to part-time? Are you glad you did it, or did you pay a big price for it in your career progress? What made it successful or not? Does your workplace cooperate with you when you're trying to navigate the needs of parenting with the needs of working? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a little bit on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And Leeson Stromberg stays with us now. She's got a new book out. It's called Work, Pause, Thrive, How to Pause for Parenthood Without Killing Your Career.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you do this at some point in your life? Are you doing it right now, taking a time out of the workforce or cutting back to part-time while you deal with the needs of parenting? Was it easy to pull off? Difficult? Took a lot of negotiation? Was it a choice or a necessity? Have you done this and gotten back into the workforce? How'd that go? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Faith joining us in Madison. Faith, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add to this wonderful conversation. I'm a grandmother, so I'm in my second round of having to put my career on pause while I'm raising my 6-year-old granddaughter. And I had been in management, working for a company that didn't allow anyone in management to have a flexible schedule or a part-time schedule. So I applied, actually, for a job very straightforwardly, saying that I was a grandmother, I was very involved, and I needed a position that could allow me the flexibility I needed. I was fortunate that I found a position like that and have been able to remain active in the workforce. But to my advantage was the fact that I did have a very supportive partner, and I also had savings enough that I could take that leap and keep my fingers crossed that everything would be okay.
Faye, thank you so much for sharing that. Got lots of interesting points there. And Lisa, let's talk about the willingness of an organization, a corporation, to take on an employee like Faye who might say up front, I want to work part-time. This is my situation. Do you think that we are seeing more workplaces that are amenable to that kind of arrangement, or is it still a tough bargain?
Well, you know, Faith, first of all, congratulations on your journey. That's so inspiring to hear. You are perfectly a wonderful work pause thrive role model. Thanks for calling in. What I'm hearing and what I'm seeing is a fascinating series of trends. So, you know, here I am in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, the average age of the employee is 30, and they're just about to hit a huge baby boom. In fact, 64 million millennials are expected to become parents in the next decade. And what do we know about millennials? Millennials tell us again and again in the research that they value time over money, although they need and want to be well paid, and they really value meaning over kind of marching up the traditional career ladder, although they do want to have successful careers. Well, guess who that sounds like? That sounds like the women of my generation and maybe Faith's generation that have been trying to navigate and innovate and trailblaze this entire time because the workplace wasn't supportive. So what we're seeing is really innovative, smart workplaces figure out that flexibility is a secret sauce to actually keeping employees engaged. And the other thing we're seeing is a real commitment to actually advancing women in leadership. So we're seeing them actually trying to unpack what can they do. Companies are doing things like providing return-to-work internships for women who've paused their careers, or men for that matter, let's be clear, it doesn't have to be a woman. So we're seeing a lot of that happening in the workplace right now. We're also seeing a real movement away from FaceTime priority to actually remote work or, you know, flexible working. You know, we have the technology now to work, you know, from home one day a week and know that work can get done. And so we're seeing some real shifts, and I actually think we're going to see more and more of that as the millennial generation becomes more and more rooted in management and actually can make decisions that will make some, we'll see some serious changes.
Lisa, I got to follow up. Back to work internships, how does that work?
Isn't that so cool?
Yeah.
So here's, it's just catching the wave. We're seeing it a lot in technology. We're seeing it in the financial services industry. We're seeing it in advertising in the industry that I'm working in. So what we're seeing is companies say, look, we have a mid-career problem. Women are leaving the workforce, college-educated women are leaving the workforce in droves. In fact, about a quarter of college-educated women leave every year for caregiving responsibilities. Well, that's a lot of really well-educated talent that the workplace needs to have back in there. They're also women, and we know all the research shows that when we have women in leadership, we're seeing great changes happen for the bottom line. It's not corporate social responsibility, it's economic. So companies are trying to figure out how do you get those mid-career women back? Well, what they've started to launch are these 3, sometimes 4, sometimes even 6 month internship where the women or the men come in and they end up doing an internship for this period of time where they actually are being trained in various areas or they're kind of working without a permanent job and then they get hired full time. And I'm seeing up to 100% retention as a result of this. And it's completely changing the pipeline to the top.
Do they get paid? Do they get paid for the internship?
Of course, absolutely, as they should. All that great talent, mid-career. Here's an example. Andrea Chermayoff was out of the workforce for 15 years, and she did a return-to-work internship at J.P. Morgan, and she's now a vice president of wealth management. I asked her, and when I interviewed her, I said, Andrea, how long did it take you to get back on track? She laughed and said, 1 year. In 1 year, no one knew that I had been out for 15 years. That's how quickly they were able to assimilate her and get her back into a senior-level position. And we're seeing that more and more. We're seeing an opportunity of all this incredible talent who refocus their energies on home matters for whatever reason, caring for parents, caring for whatever, and are now able to recommit to the workplace full-time and are just thriving.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Leeson Stromberg, the author of Work, Pause, Thrive, How to Pause for Parenthood Without Killing Your Career. And we go to Becky joining us in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I work at a public library, and I work part-time so that I can be at home more, you know, obviously. I just wonder if any other women or men who decide to take this track have problems with other coworkers and how they find it sort of easy for, well, you only work part-time, so it's easier for you to take care of your kids or, you know, sort of stuff like that.
You know, Becky, thanks for calling in, and thank you for the good work in the library. We love libraries. Here's the truth of it. I think that we have a workplace that really honors and promotes and advances the ideal worker. And that ideal worker is really that 1950s model, and typically a man who's in the workplace working full-time 24/7. He can travel at the drop of the hat and do all things. And the reason he can do that is typically he has a spouse at home who can care for those little distractions we call life, right? And the truth of the matter is that model used to work. It really did work for a long time. It doesn't work anymore because we actually have to have two career couples to support just living in the United States these days, right? So what we're seeing is many, many, and it's typically women, downshifting to work part-time or pausing for a period of time because they have to, not necessarily because they want to. But the problem is the workplace still honors and reveres that all-in ideal worker. So unfortunately, someone like you may suffer, you know, environments where the colleagues say, well, I'm working like a dog and you're not, that's not fair. What I saw in my research is that a number of women said who had worked part-time or downshifted ended up leaving their companies and going elsewhere because they faced motherhood bias. They faced this ideal worker bias and motherhood bias that said, well, you've got these other distractions, you're not committed. So the only way that they could really reinvent themselves was to go somewhere else and take their talents elsewhere. What a loss for a company, don't you think?
Well, Becky, thanks a lot for that question. Appreciate that. And Leeson, is there a downside to this? Did you hear from women
sure.
who said, I didn't make as much money over the course of
yes.
my career? What is the downside?
Yes, money is absolutely one of the number one downsides. Look, if you're unemployed or you reduce your hours, you're going to be paid less. That means you're putting less money into your retirement. You're putting less money into your family to support your family. And that absolutely, you know, and then, of course, divorce happens, death happens, job loss happens. It's a risk. And so what I do in the book is I really try and explain how you can strategically support yourself. If you choose to downshift your career, what can you do over the long haul to support yourself? There was no way for me to analyze when I paused my career for 2 years what it would do financially, what the impact would be. But there's a really fascinating calculator that you can find from New American Progress. If you actually type in stay-at-home calculator, I think you can find it. It's referenced in the book. And they'll tell you, if this is your salary and you decide to take out, this will be the long-term implications for your family's budget. It's a little surprising.
In that you take a bigger hit than you think you're going to take?
I think that's true, because not only are you losing your actual income, you're losing the 401k benefits, you're losing, you know, disability insurance, you're losing all these things, right? And then what you don't realize is that over the course of time, your career might have moved on track faster, et cetera. So there are financial implications, and you have to decide if you're willing to make those compromises. Many of the women I spoke to actually said, in fact, I was surprised, 78% of the women who paused their careers. So, again, the vast majority of the women I surveyed did pause their careers, which in itself surprised me. 78% said they had no regrets, even though they did take financial hits. That they actually said it was worth it for their overall life quality and satisfaction. To me, that was really interesting.
Well, Leeson, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Liesen Stromberg. She's a journalist, a speaker, and the author of the book, Work, Pause, Thrive, How to Pause for Parenthood Without Killing Your Career. She's also the COO of the 3% Movement. And you can let us know what you think. Is this something that you've had experience with in your life? Did you take a pause in your career, maybe decide to stay home? Maybe you had a new baby. Maybe you were caring for parents. And did you try to get back into the workforce? How did that work out for you? Any regrets? Would you do it again? And what advice do you have? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
News out today from the American Kennel Club. The Labrador Retriever is top dog. Again, it's the most popular dog now for a record-breaking 26 years in a row.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to love a lab. They're sporty, they're good at catching things, and they've also been known to save lives.
The American Kennel Club points out that the Rottweiler is moving up the list pretty quickly. Rottweilers are known for being protective, intelligent, and willing to work. They're in the top 10.
And the German Shepherd, by the way, number two, it's another working dog. And a nod to the little guy. Terriers are on the move. The Russell Terrier leaped up 14 spots, and the Rat Terrier rose 5 spots.
So what kind of dog would you choose if you were to, you don't have a dog right now.
I have some. I have some dogs. I don't know. In-law is not the right word. They're my mom's dogs, so they're kind of like my dogs. Phineas and Sophie. Shetland Sheepdogs are very sweet. Phineas is some indeterminate breed, I think, of dog. And
you think it's a dog?
You know,
it's
hard to tell with Phineas. Could be
a
dingo. But, you know, West Highland White Terrier, that's my dream
dog.
And a Newfie, a Newfoundland. What about you?
I'm not, you know, I like other people's dogs, not always a dog person myself. But if I had to get a dog, and I was going to get a purebred dog, Samoyed, all the way. They're just the coolest dogs. I think they're really neat.
They are really
cool
beautiful.
Looking and majestic.
They're fluffy, white fur.
Or whatever the pound had, if I went that way, too. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.